it hurts worse than before.
This is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti. Today I got a lecture I recorded back in 2005 in LA with Noam Chomsky. His stuff is still poignant to this day. You know, and as usual, use your own brain, practice critical thinking when listening to anybody, and find diverse sources. But Chomsky is a pretty good handle on foreign affairs. So that's coming up here on Talk Is Cheap, and I'm going to read you my letter from Ron Wyden, just briefly. I don't like to read a lot of copy, so it's just three little paragraphs of response to my letter, and give you a little spiel on that. So yeah. So don't forget, Modern Mono is coming up after this show at 5. Tomorrow at 5, between 5 and 8, is Dr. Zoom. You want to check his show out, especially if you like the music on this show. He's got the greatest music you've never heard on Dr. Zoom, 5 to 8 on Sundays, with a live broadcast of a local band on the end of the month. So I just always give a few things. I've added legalized drugs. We need to legalize drugs and treat people as mentally handicapped, that for lack of a better term, that are drug addicts. They're not criminals. They need help. So we need to legalize drugs, and that'll stop a lot of the crime in Central and South America too. In fact, I've heard, I don't know if it's true. I thought that the Medellin cartel actually is trying to stop the legalization of drugs because they wouldn't make as much money. Foreign direct investment, too. Need to get a handle on foreign direct investment. Look that up. What else? Radioforall.net. Support them and all independent media, if you would, please. So coming up here on KEPW 97.3 Low Power FM Eugene Peaceworks Community Radio is Noam Chomsky, 2005, Los Angeles. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. We'll be right back. All right. So for those of you who don't know, I've been trying to get the subsidies. I mean, let's face it, whether you believe in capitalism or not, you don't. A true conservative does not want subsidies. So why are we subsidizing deforestation, for instance? And why do we subsidize fossil fuels? I mean, if we had true capitalism, we would have gotten rid of this stuff. We would have been using solar panels years ago. I mean, they were invented at the turn of the 20th century. They've been solar technology has been around that long. We certainly would have been off fossil fuels, and trees would have been very expensive to cut if they weren't radically subsidized. So, unfortunately, though, the subsidies, the companies like Weyerhaeuser, everyone's pension is invested in these companies. So it's not quite as simple as you think, just waving your hand and saying and telling them to do something. So what I've been trying to do is get the subsidies for cutting down trees. I mean, they have a subsidy for wood stoves, okay? People don't live in caves anymore. We don't need wood stoves, especially if we had rooftop solar and powered your heater with rooftop solar. We don't need a subsidy to encourage wood heat, okay? So even though that affects poor people, they need heat. But of course, if you use that to put solar panels on their roofs, you wouldn't have to subsidize wood stoves. So that's just an example of we subsidize the roads. I heard it's $1 million a mile to put roads in the forest. So if that was used to plant trees and to use other types of building materials and encourage higher tech houses that used higher paid jobs and some loan guarantees for the people that are buying them instead of subsidizing cutting down trees. So that's what I was advocating with the letter that I wrote Ron Ryden and have written the governor and a bunch of other people. And I guess I'm going to write Environmental Quality Commission, too. I didn't notice that in here. So this is what Senator Ron Wyden wrote me back. And by the way, I don't know if this is a coincidence or not, but I get a letter at the same time that I get a letter back from him. I get a jury summons. So I just found that kind of interesting that I haven't had a jury summons in like 20 some odd years, I don't think. And at that, I think I've only had one jury summons ever. And the moment I write Senator Wyden, I get a jury summons. So that was a little weird. All right. So from Senator Ron Wyden, thank you for contacting me to promote Oregon recycling efforts and share your ideas for making the system work better. I am proud that Oregon is recognized as a leader in conservation, and recycling has become second nature for many Oregonians. So, and I, spoiler alert, he doesn't address what I wrote at all. I guess this is a form letter if you listen. Last year brought many changes for the recycling market as China put in place a ban on importing recyclable materials amid concerns about ongoing contamination problems and environmental harms. Local recyclers are tweaking what they accept at the curb and increasing consumer education to recycle right and lessen contamination. I commend you for speaking out on this issue and urge you to get involved at the state and local level, working toward increasing recycling participation throughout your community and emphasizing the importance of properly sorting items to increase their value as recyclable commodities. You'll be pleased to know that the State Environmental Quality Commission has a working group that is discussing everything from market opportunities to rethinking waste management. Excuse me, I remain optimistic that recycling rates can increase and will continue to support their efforts. Thank you again for keeping me appraised of issues that are important to you. Please do not hesitate to contact me in the future if I may be of further assistance on this or any other matter. Ron Wyden, United States Senate. All right, so the problem I'm having with that is, first of all, he doesn't address what I was talking about, the subsidies at all, but because there's money already there. But, in the Netherlands, and I don't know, there's certain countries that they have like six recycling bins and they expect you to sort your trash, and that's cool. I mean, I wish we could do that here, but as a start, couldn't we have a deposit on cardboard and then pay people? Here's a job for people that would be a fairly well paid job to sort. I'm willing to pay people to sort cardboard, recycling. It would create a job in this supposedly economy where the technology is going to take all of our jobs. here's a job right here. And I got to say, even Lars Larson, that fascist pig Lars Larson, gets on there for a week ranting about all these Amazon boxes that he has for buying, that he's, where he's bought stuff from Scamazon, and has a bunch of boxes that he doesn't know what to do with. And so even he was saying he wishes there was some way to recycle all these cardboard boxes that he has piling up in his hallway. So, you know, it takes a word on embodied energy. Those of you who are listening, you know, I do sustainable. I call myself DJ Susti because I studied sustainable design for quite a while now. There's a thing called embodied energy. And when you, it's better to build a house, for instance, out of bottles, than it takes a lot of energy to recycle bottles. So yes, it would take a lot of energy to recycle cardboard, but if you were to use rooftop solar, that energy would come from the sun, and everything would be hunky-dory, and the energy problem would be solved, and you'd have all kinds of jobs. So, and then one other word is, again, I just want to stress that people's pensions are invested in places like Weyerhaeuser. So, I mean, I've been arrested for the trees. I'd love to get rid of Weyerhaeuser completely. But if you did that, it would affect people's pensions, and it would cause an economic disaster, which I guess some people would like. But as in my old age, I'm not so sure about that. So here's where these subsidies could be used to plant trees, and Weyerhaeuser and et al. Will have to diversify, just like the oil industry and the coal industry. You're going to have to retool. You can't just go on, you can't just go on forever when this is called progress. We have new technology now. We don't need to burn fossil fuels. We don't need to cut trees down. We have other things that you can build houses out of anything. They've been built out of mud. People are building them out of old missile silos. So there's no need to cut down trees. And although I wouldn't be against, using wood for ornamental things, maybe, but it would have to be, wood should be very high priced and very costly to use wood. Meanwhile, I'm looking at the current construction right now. I mean, the entire building is made out of wood. That's ridiculous. Especially when steel has been recycled. Most steel is anywhere from 70 to like 90% recycled as steel. And if it is used properly, it is still fire resistant. And there's no reason to make an entire building out of wood anymore. And it would take, you may have to get some trained labor in there. All right, so let me play you a tune here. And coming up, Noam Chomsky, the Nominator from LA 2005, the socialist with the mostest, the most cunning linguist of all time, Noam Chomsky, coming up here on KEPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Community, Peacework Community Radio. Simulcast on KEPW.org. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Oh, fracking too. We don't need to subsidize fracking. Sorry.
Time I feel my
Like I promised, the nominator, Noam Chomsky, 2005, L.A., the socialist with the mostest, the most cunning linguist of all time, Noam Chomsky.
States to stop the bombing, to try to save millions of victims. As far as I'm I'm aware that it was unreported. It was Monday. Yesterday, the aid, major aid agencies, Oxfam and other Christian Aid and others, joined in that plea. You can find a report in the New York Times. There was a line in the Boston Globe hidden in a story about another topic, Kashmir. Well, I could easily go on. But all of that, first of all, indicates to us what's happening. Looks like what's happening is some kind of silent genocide. It also gives a good deal of insight into the elite culture, the culture that we're part of. It indicates that what will happen, we don't know, but plans are being made and programs implemented on the assumption that they may lead to the death of several million people in the next couple of weeks. Very casually, with no comment, no particular thought about it, that's just kind of normal. Here, and in good part of Europe, not in the rest of the world. In fact, not even much of Europe. So if you read the Irish press or the press in Scotland, say, that close, reactions are very different. Well, that's what's happening now. What's happening now is very much under our control. We can do a lot to affect what's happening. And that's roughly it. Let's turn to the slightly more abstract questions, forgetting for the moment that we're in the midst of apparently trying to murder 3 or 4 million people, not Taliban, of course, they're victims. Let's go back, turn to the question of the historic event that took place in September 11th. And as I said, I think that's correct. It was a historic event. Not, unfortunately, because of its scale. Unpleasant to think about, but in terms of the scale, it's not that unusual. I did say it's the worst, probably the worst instant human toll of any crime, and that may be true. But there are terrorist crimes with effects a bit more drawn out that are much more extreme, unfortunately. Nevertheless, it's a historic event, because there was a change. The change was the direction in which the guns were pointing. That's new, radically new. So it takes a U.S. history. The last time that the national territory of the United States was under attack, or for that matter, even threatened, was when the British burned down Washington in 1814. There have been many common, it was common to bring up Pearl Harbor, but that's not a good analogy. The Japanese, whatever you think about it, the Japanese bombed military bases in 2 U.S. colonies, not the national territory. Colonies which had been taken from their inhabitants in not a very pretty way. This is the national territory that's been attacked on a large scale. Find a few fringe examples, but this is unique. During these close to 200 years, we, United States, expelled or mostly exterminated the indigenous population, many billion people, conquered half of Mexico, carried out depredations all over the region, Central America, sometimes beyond, conquered Hawaii and the Philippines, killing several hundred thousand Filipinos in the process. Since the Second World War, it's extended its reach around the world in ways I don't have to describe, but it was always killing someone else. The fighting was somewhere else. It was others who were getting slaughtered, not here, not the national territory. In the case of Europe, the change is even more dramatic because its history is even more horrendous than ours. We are an offshoot of Europe, basically. For hundreds of years, Europe has been casually slaughtering people all over the world. So they conquered the world, not by handing out candy to babies. During this period, Europe did suffer murderous wars, but that was European killers murdering one another. The main sport of Europe for hundreds of years was slaughtering one another. The only reason it came to an end in 1945 was had nothing to do with democracies not making war on each other and other fashionable notions. That had to do with the fact that everyone understood that the next time they play the game is going to be the end for the world, because the Europeans, including us, had developed such massive weapons of destruction that that game just has to be over. And it goes back hundreds of years. I mean, in the 17th century, about probably 40% of the population of Germany was wiped out in one war. But during this whole bloody, murderous period, it was Europeans slaughtering each other and Europeans slaughtering people elsewhere. The Congo didn't attack Belgium. India didn't attack England. Algeria didn't attack France. It's uniform. And there are, again, small exceptions, but pretty small in scale, certainly invisible on the scale of what Europe and us were doing to the rest of the world. This is the first change. The first time that the guns have been pointed the other way. In my opinion, that's probably why you see such different reactions on the two sides of the Irish Sea, which I've noticed, incidentally, in many interviews on both sides, national radio on both sides. The world looks very different depending whether you're holding the lash or whether you're being whipped by it for hundreds of years. Very different. So I think the shock and surprise in Europe and its offshoots, like here, is very understandable. It is a historic event, but regrettably not in scale, in something else. And a reason why most of the rest of the world looks at it quite differently. Not that lacking sympathy for the victims of the atrocity or being horrified by them, that's almost uniform, but viewing it from a different perspective. Something we might want to understand. Let's go to the third question. What is the war against terrorism? And side question, what's terrorism? The war against terrorism has been described in high places as a struggle against a plague, a cancer, which is spread by barbarians, by depraved opponents of civilization itself. That's a feeling that I share. The words I'm quoting, however, happen to be from 20 years ago. That's President Reagan and his Secretary of State. The Reagan administration came into office 20 years ago declaring that the war against international terrorism would be the core of our foreign policy, describing it in terms of the kind I just mentioned and others. It was the core of our foreign policy. The Reagan administration responded to this plague spread by depraved opponents of civilization itself by creating an extraordinary international terrorist network, totally unprecedented in scale, which carried out massive atrocities all over the world, primarily, well, partly nearby, but not only there. I won't run through the record. You're all educated people, so I'm sure you learned about it in high school. I'll just mention one case, which is totally uncontroversial, so we don't have to argue about it. By no means the most extreme, but uncontroversial. It's uncontroversial because of the judgments of the highest international authorities, the International Court of Justice, the World Court, and the UN Security Council. So this one is uncontroversial, at least among people who have some minimal concern for international law, human rights, justice, and other things like that. And now I'll leave you an exercise. You can estimate the size of that category by simply asking how often this uncontroversial case has been mentioned in the commentary of the last month. And it's a particularly relevant one, not only because it's uncontroversial, but because it does offer a precedent as to how a law-abiding state did respond, in fact, to a case of international terrorism, which is uncontroversial, was even more extreme than the events of September 11th. I'm talking about the Reagan-U.S. war against Nicaragua, which left tens of thousands of people dead, the country ruined, perhaps beyond recovery. Nicaragua did respond. They didn't respond by setting off bombs in Washington. They responded by taking it to the World Court, presenting a case. They had no the other evidence. The World Court accepted their case, ruled in their favor, ordered the condemned what they called the unlawful use of force, which is another word for international terrorism by the United States, ordered the United States to terminate the crime and to pay massive reparations. The United States, of course, dismissed the court judgment with total contempt and announced that it would not accept the jurisdiction of the court henceforth. Nicaragua then went to the UN Security Council, which considered a resolution calling on all states to observe international law. No one was mentioned, but everyone understood. The United States vetoed the resolution that now stands as the only state on record which has both been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism and has vetoed the Security Council resolution calling on states to observe international law. Nicaragua then went to the General Assembly, where there's technically no veto, but a negative U.S. vote amounts to a veto. It passed a similar resolution with only the United States, Israel, and El Salvador opposed. The following year, again, this time the United States could only rally Israel to the cause, so two votes opposed to observing international law. At that point, Nicaragua couldn't do anything lawful. It tried all the measures. They don't work in a world that is ruled by force. This case, I would say, is uncontroversial, but it's by no means the most extreme. It's also very, we gain a lot of insight into our own culture and society and what's happening now by asking how much we know about all this and how much we talk about it. How much you learn about it in school, you know, how much it's all over the front pages, and this is only the beginning. The United States responded to the World Court and the Security Council by immediately escalating the war very quickly. That was a bipartisan decision, incidentally. The terms of the war were also changed. For the first time, there were official orders given, official orders, to the terrorist army to attack what are called soft targets. Meaning undefended civilian targets, and to keep away from the Nicaraguan army. They were able to do that because the United States had total control of the air over Nicaragua and was able to, the Revolutionary Army was supplied with advanced communication equipment. It wasn't a guerrilla army in the normal sense, and could get instructions about the disposition of Nicaraguan army forces so they could attack agricultural collectives, health clinics, and so on, soft targets with impunity. Those were the official orders. Now, what was the reaction? It was known. It was a reaction to it. The policy was regarded as sensible by left liberal opinion. Michael Kinsley, who represents the left in mainstream discussion, wrote an article in which he said that we shouldn't be too quick to criticize this policy, as Human Rights Watch had just done. He said, a sensible policy must meet the cost of the test of cost-benefit analysis. That is, and I'm quoting now, an analysis of the amount of blood and misery that will be poured in and the likelihood that democracy will emerge at the other end. Democracy, as the U.S. Understands the term, which is graphically illustrated in the surrounding countries. Notice that it's axiomatic that the United States, U.S. elites, have the right to conduct the analysis and to pursue the project if it passes their tests. And it did pass their tests. It worked. When Nicaragua finally succumbed to a superpower assault, commentators openly and cheerfully lauded the success of the methods that were adopted and described them accurately. So I'll quote Time magazine, just to pick one, lauded the success of the methods adopted to wreck the economy and prosecute a long and deadly proxy war until the exhausted natives overthrow the unwanted government themselves with a cost to us that is minimal, and leaving the victims with wrecked bridges, sabotaged power stations, and ruined farms, and thus providing the U.S. candidate with a winning issue, ending the impoverishment of the people of Nicaragua. The New York Times had a headline saying, Americans united in joy. culture in which we live. And it reveals several facts. One is the fact that terrorism works. It doesn't fail. It works. Violence usually works. That's world history. Secondly, it's a very serious analytic error to say, as is commonly done, that terrorism is a weapon of the weak. Like other means of violence, it's primarily a weapon of the strong, overwhelmingly, in fact. It is held to be a weapon of the weak because the strong also control the doctrinal systems, and their terror doesn't count as terror. And that's close to universal. I can't think of an exception, historical exception. Even the worst mass murderers viewed the world that way. So take the Nazis. They weren't carrying out terror in occupied Europe. They were protecting the population from the terrorism of the partisans. And like other resistance movements, there was terrorism. The Nazis were carrying out counter-terror. Furthermore, the United States essentially agreed with that. After the war, the U.S. Army did extensive studies of Nazi counter-terror operations in Europe. First, I should say that the U.S. picked them up and began carrying them out itself, often against the same targets, the former resistance. But the army, the military also studied the Nazi methods, published interesting studies, sometimes critical of them because they were inefficiently carried out. So there's a critical analysis of, do this right, do that right. But those methods, with the advice of Wehrmacht officers who were brought over here, became the manuals of counterinsurgency, of counterterror, low-intensity conflict, as it's called, and are the manuals and are the procedures that are being used. So it's not just that the Nazis did it, it's that it was regarded as the right thing to do by the leaders of Western civilization, that is, us, who then proceeded to do it themselves. Terrorism is not the weapon of the weak. It is the weapon of those who are against us, whoever us happens to be. And if you can find a historical exception to that, I'd be interested in seeing it. An interesting indication of the nature of our culture, our high culture, is the way in which all of this is regarded. One way it's regarded is just suppressing it, so almost nobody's ever heard of it. And the power of American propaganda and doctrine is so strong that even among the victims it's barely known. I mean, when you talk to this about this to people in Argentina, you have to remind them before they say, oh yeah, that happened, we forgot about it, it's deeply suppressed. The sheer consequences of the monopoly of violence can be very powerful. In ideological and other terms. One illuminating aspect of our own attitude toward terrorism, ours, is the reaction to the idea that Nicaragua might have the right to defend itself. Actually, I went through this in some detail with database searches and that sort of thing. The idea that Nicaragua might have the right to defend itself was considered outrageous. There is virtually nothing in mainstream commentary indicating that Nicaragua might have that right. And that fact was exploited by the Reagan administration and its propaganda in an interesting way. Those of you who are around at that time will remember that they periodically floated rumors that the Nicaraguans were getting MiG jets from Russia. At that point, the hawks and the doves split. The hawk said, okay, let's bomb. The dove said, wait a minute, let's see if the rumors are true. And if the rumors are true, then let's bomb, because they're a threat to the United States. Why, incidentally, were they getting MiGs? Well, because the United States, they tried to get jet planes from European countries, but the United States put pressure on its allies so they wouldn't send them means of defense because they wanted them to turn to the Russians. That's good for propaganda purposes. Then they become a threat to us. Right? Remember, they were just two days' march from Harlingen, Texas. We actually declared a national emergency in 1985 to protect the country from the threat of Nicaragua. And it stayed in force. But so it was much better for them to get arms from the Russians. Why would they want jet planes? for the reasons that I already mentioned. The United States had total control of their airspace, was overflying it, and using that to provide instructions to the terrorist army to enable them to attack soft targets without running into the army that might defend them. So therefore, but when, and everyone knew that that was the reason, you know, they're not going to use their jet planes for anything else. But the idea that Nicaragua should be permitted to defend its airspace against a superpower attack that is directing terrorist forces to attack undefended civilian targets, that was considered in the United States outrageous, and uniformly so. Exceptions are so slight, you know, I practically list them. I don't suggest that you take my word for this. Have a look. Includes our own senators, incidentally. Another illustration of how we regard terrorism is happening right now. The U.S. has just appointed an ambassador to the United Nations to lead the war against terrorism a couple of weeks ago. Who is he? Well, his name is John Negroponte. He was the U.S. ambassador in the fiefdom, which is what it is, of Honduras in the early 1980s. There was a little fuss made about the fact that he must have been aware, as he certainly was, of the large-scale murders and other atrocities that were being carried out by the security forces in Honduras that we were supporting, but that's a small part of it. As proconsul of Honduras, as he was called there, he was the local supervisor for the terrorist war based in Honduras, for which his government was condemned by the World Court, and then Security Council in a vetoed resolution. And he was just appointed as the UN ambassador to lead the war against terror. Another small experiment you can do is check and see what the reaction was to this. Well, tell you what you're going to find, but find it for yourself. That tells us a lot about the war against terrorism and about ourselves. The United States took over the country again under the conditions that were so graphically described by the press, the country is totally, it was pretty much destroyed in the 1980s, but it's totally collapsed since in every respect, just about economically. It's declined sharply since the U.S. takeover, democratically in every other respect. It's now the second poorest country in the hemisphere. I'm not going to talk about it, but I mentioned that I picked up Nicaragua because it's an uncontroversial case. If you look at the other states in the region, the state terror was far more extreme. And it again traces back to Washington, and that's by no means all. It was happening elsewhere in the world too, so take, say, Africa. During the Reagan years alone, South African attacks backed by the United States and Britain, South African, U.S., UK-backed South African attacks against the neighboring countries that killed about 1.5 million people and left $16 billion of damage and countries destroyed. And if we go around the world, we can add more examples. Now, that was the first war against terror, of which I've given a small sample. Are we supposed to pay attention to that or kind of think that might be relevant? After all, it's not exactly ancient history. Well, evidently not, as you can tell by looking at the current discussion of the war on terror, which has been the leading topic for the last month. I mentioned that Nicaragua has now become the second poorest country in the hemisphere. What's the first, the poorest country? Well, that's, of course, Haiti, which also happens to be the victim of most U.S. intervention in the 20th century by a long shot, which has left it totally devastated. It's the poorest country. Nicaragua is second rank in degree of U.S. intervention in the 22nd century. It's the second poorest. Actually, it's vying with Guatemala. They interchange every year or two as to who's the second poorest. And they also vie as to which is the leading target of U.S. military intervention. We're supposed to think that all of this is some sort of accident. You know, has nothing to do with anything that happened in history. Maybe. The worst human rights violation human rights violation. In 1999, Colombia replaced Turkey as the leading recipient of U.S. arms worldwide, excluding Israel and Egypt, which are a separate category. And that tells us a lot more about the war on terror right now, in fact. Why was Turkey getting such a huge flow of U.S. arms? Well, take a look at the flow of U.S. arms to Turkey. Turkey always got a lot of U.S. arms. It's strategically placed, a member of NATO, and so on. But the arms flow to Turkey went up very sharply in 1984. That had nothing to do with the Cold War, when Russia was collapsing. It stayed high from 1984 until 1999, when it reduced and it was replaced in the lead by Colombia. What happened from 1984 to 1999? Well, in 1984, Colombia launched a major terrorist war against the Kurds in southeastern Turkey. And that's when U.S. aid went up, military aid. And this was not pistols. This is jet planes, tanks, military training, and so on. And it stayed high as the atrocities escalated through the 1990s. Aid followed it. The peak year was 1997. In 1997, U.S. aid to military aid to Turkey was more than the entire period, 1950 to 1983, that is the Cold War period, which is an indication of how much the Cold War has affected policy. And the results were awesome. This led to 2 to 3 million refugees, some of the worst ethnic cleansing of the late 1990s, tens of thousands of people killed, 3,500 towns and villages destroyed, way more than Kosovo, even under NATO bombs. And the United States is providing 80% of the arms, increasing as the atrocities increased, peaking in 1997. It declined in 1999 because, once again, terror worked, as it usually does, when carried out by its major agents, namely the powerful. So by 1999, Turkish terror, called, of course, counter-terror, but as I said, that's universal, it worked. Therefore, Turkey was replaced by Colombia, which had not yet succeeded in its terrorist war, and therefore had to move into first place as recipient of U.S. arms. Well, what makes this all particularly striking is that all of this was taking place right in the midst of a huge flood of self-congratulation on the part of Western intellectuals, which probably has no counterpart in history. I mean, you all remember, it was just a couple of years ago, massive self-adulation about how, for the first time in history, we are so magnificent that we are standing up for principles and values and dedicated to ending inhumanity everywhere and the new era of this and that and so on and so forth. And we certainly can't tolerate atrocities right near the borders of NATO. That was repeated over and over. Only within the borders of NATO, where we can not only tolerate much worse atrocities, but contribute to them. Well, another insight into Western civilization and our own is how often this was brought up. Try to look. I won't repeat it, but it's instructive. It's a pretty impressive feat for a propaganda system to carry this off in a free society. It's pretty amazing. I think you could do this in a totalitarian state. And Turkey is very grateful. Just a few days ago, the Prime Minister, David, announced that Turkey would join the coalition against terror very enthusiastically, even more so than others. In fact, he said it would contribute troops, which others have not been willing to do. And he explained why. He said, we owe a debt of gratitude to the United States, because the United States was the only country that was willing to contribute so massively to our own, in his words, counter-terrorist war, that is, to our own massive ethnic cleansing and atrocities and terror. No other countries, no. You know, they helped a little, but they stayed back. The United States, on the other hand, contributed enthusiastically and decisively, and was able to do so because of the silence, servility might be the right word, of the educated classes who can easily find out about it. Now, it's a free country, after all. You can read human rights reports, you can read all sorts of stuff, but chose to contribute to the atrocities, and Turkey is very happy to. They owe us a bit of gratitude for that, and therefore will contribute troops, just as during the war over in Serbia, Turkey was very much praised for using its F-16s, which we supplied to bomb Serbia, exactly as it had been doing with the same planes against its own population up until the time when it finally succeeded in crushing internal terror, as they called it. And as usual, as always, resistance does include terror. It's true of the American Revolution. That's true of every case I know. Just as it's true that those who have a monopoly of violence talk about themselves as carrying out counter-terror. Well, that's pretty impressive. And that has to do with the coalition against that is now being organized to fight the war against terror. And it's very interesting to see how that coalition is being described. So have a look at this morning's Christian Science Monitor. That's a good newspaper, one of the best international newspapers with real coverage of the world. The lead story, the front page story, is about how the United States, you know, people used to dislike the United States, but now they're beginning to respect it, and they're very happy about the way the U.S. is leading the war against terror. And the prime example, in fact, the only serious example, the others are a joke, is Algeria. It turns out that Algeria is very enthusiastic about the U.S. war against terror. The person who wrote the article is an expert on Africa. He must know that Algeria is one of the most vicious terror states in the world and has been carrying out horrendous terror against its own population in the past couple of years, in fact. For a while, this was under wraps, but it was finally exposed in France with defectors from the Algerian army. It's all over the place there, and in England and so on. But here, we're very proud because one of the worst terror states in the world is now enthusiastically welcoming the U.S. war on terror, and in fact is cheering on the United States to lead the war. That shows how popular we're getting. And if you look at the coalition that's being formed against terror, it tells you a lot more. A leading member of the coalition is Russia, which is delighted to have the United States support its murderous terrorist war in Chechnya, instead of occasionally criticizing it in the background. China's joining enthusiastically. It's delighted to have support for the atrocities it's carrying out in Western China against what it calls Muslim secessionists. Turkey, as I mentioned, is very happy with the war against terror. They're experts in Algeria, Indonesia. Delighted to have even more U.S. support for atrocities that it's carrying out in Aceh and elsewhere. Now we can run through the list. The list of the states that have joined the coalition against terror is quite impressive. They have a characteristic in common. They are among the leading terror states in the world, and they happen to be led by the world champion. Well, that brings us back to the question, what is terrorism? Assuming we understand it, but what is it? Well, there happen to be some easy answers to this. And there is an official definition. You can find it in the U.S. Code or in U.S. Army manuals. Brief statement of it, taken from a U.S. Army manual, is fair enough, is that terror is the calculated use of violence or the threat of violence to attain political or religious ideological goals through intimidation, coercion, or instilling fear. That's terrorism. That's a fair enough definition. It's reasonable to accept that. The problem is it can't be accepted, because if you accept that, all the wrong consequences follow. For example, the consequences I've just been reviewing. Now, there is a major effort right now at the UN to try to develop...
Okay, of course, that is Noam Chomsky, recorded in 2005 in Los Angeles. Stay tuned for Modern Mono on KEPW. This monster mouse, he's 10 feet tall.
to wander.